From an internet fraught with danger, three heroes brave the void to bring you the Digital and Dice Podcast.
This is the Digital and Dice Podcast for Monday, July 2nd. Yes, 2nd. The second day. Not the first, not the third, but the second. 2018, and show number 155 is go. I am your host, Mark Boutte. Also, apparently, Alfred von Canadian Bun Holiday.
And I am insert Brian here. Extended monologue.
And I'm the one called Justin. Awkward friendship.
And we do not have a guest to introduce. You know what? I'm actually going to skip that one. Regardless of what you put there, I think I'm just going to skip the fact that not we don't have a guest.
Because we don't have a guest.
And if only because of the fact that, well, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Otherwise, it just kind of seems like it's kind of sad. Anyway, speaking of sad, what have you guys been up to lately?
Well, ooh. I've been getting ready for some of Tier West War, which I understand is you'll find it sad because you're sitting at home this year.
It is true. I will not be going to Tier West War this
some
year.
Some of that pre-show is filtering into the show.
This is a safe podcast.
We're all friends here.
There's no judgment. We are here for each other to put out interesting information and entertainment for those who wish to tune in.
Yes, but I have been spending the past week preparing war gear and camping gear and getting excited for a week of camping.
Neat.
Cool.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
That'll be fun, yeah. Mm-hmm. And you guys are leaving like on the 4th of July, yeah?
Oh, yeah. No, like at 7 in the morning on the 4th of July, because that way we can beat it through Portland before traffic turns to crap.
That's absolutely true. Which, by the way, I think this is a good opportunity to say that there will be no live show next week on Wednesday, the 4th of July.
We'll most likely be either having a barbecue or blowing things up, or both.
We may indeed live stream it from our phones or something. I'm trying to make something happen, just as a hi everyone, do a thing, 4th of July, happy fun times.
We're actually going to have Brian do some live streaming from the event that he'll be at on that day.
Because there's no connection whatsoever.
I was going to say, are you driving or are you being driven down there?
Sound guy Steven's driving. I'm with Sound Guy Steven and Kara. So.
Okay, so you'll be in the car, so you have plenty of time to live stream on your way down there.
Just give us a flow of consciousness the whole way.
Yeah, yeah. We want our YouTube channel and our Twitch channels to just be constantly being broadcast with whatever is on Brian's mind.
Really don't think that's a good idea.
I do. I think it's fantastic.
It's an amazing idea. And it would be a great 4th of July special to show off how awesome and wonderful this country can be by having you just meander through your mind and just vomit it out on the internet.
I disagree. But also, we've gotten some Warhammer 40K in.
Yes.
As well as I realized something terrible. I don't even have to field my Wordbearer's army. I literally can just field two detachments of 1,000 Sons and Death Guard now.
Mm-hmm.
And then just drown everyone in psychic powers.
Yeah, yeah, you absolutely can. There have been, actually there's been a lot of 40K stuff happening recently with the dawning of a possible Warhammer 40K narrative campaign that I'm going to be running with some of our friends, those who are actually interested in it. No. I actually did consider inviting Justin, but he's been so adamantly against playing 40K that I didn't even bother giving him the invite.
I will not be pulled back into wasting money. I'm already wasting other places on more miniatures.
Right, right. And see, that's the thing is, you have plenty of
miniatures.
You say
that. No. You say that, but I know myself.
That's fair.
I will look and be like, these are cool. But that thing's cooler.
And as a matter of fact, we introduced our friend McMindflayer to Warhammer 40K.
Did he immediately lose 4 paychecks?
To what he did is then immediately, he texted me the other night and was like,
bought $8,000 worth of minis!
He's like, do you realize what you've done is you've introduced Warhammer 40K to a person with a lot of free time and discretionary funds?
I can't afford my mortgage!
He's like, I may have bought things. He's played one game and now he went out and bought more minis, so... We're going to have to sit down and figure out what he's got soon so that we can go through it. But point is...
That's exactly why I won't be doing it.
Right. And of course, our other friends, Kat and Milo, went out and bought more minis for themselves and are doing that. So it's now become an escalation problem. And yeah.
I don't have enough funds to cover myself throughout the week most weeks. I can't afford to get into another hobby. I just can't.
So basically, there's been a lot of that going on just for the fun of it. And the prepping of that, the figuring out of the actual campaign rules and all that. And yes, Hybrid Divide, indeed, you will be involved in this as soon as you can get your butt down here and learn how to play.
Yeah, come on.
That'll be good.
We put together an army selection for you.
Absolutely.
We even tested it.
Yeah. But aside from that, that's pretty much that's pretty much been like my past 2 weeks now. A lot of 40K stuff. A little bit of Hollow Knight on the Switch. Mm. It's been fun. Some editing. Also, we do have some announcements probably later in the show about some of our shows and what we're doing with some of our release schedules. If only because of the fact that we are going to be talking a little bit about spreading out some of our shows to make editing easier, to work with other scheduling stuff. So we'll talk about that in the shout-out section later on in the show. Mm. But for now, I think it is a good idea for us to move on in the general direction of whatever Justin was doing this last week.
No, it's fine. You lined it all up. Let's.
Yeah, I lined it up, and then I came to a screeching halt so you could tell us what you've been up to.
I've been really active on Twitter. I've been doing a lot of editing for a piece I started in March. No, April. May? May.
Okay.
To try and get that out to as many people as I can to do some proofreading on. I've been enjoying the hell out of doing the very short fiction 365 thing on Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of social media, a lot of pre-planning for other projects down the road. It's nice. Been good. Not cool. A lot of gaming, but everything else.
That's fair.
Mm.
All right. Well, in that case, then, why don't we go ahead and move on to our main topic, which goes a little something like this.
It's a trap.
GM 201, Traps and Treachery. Using traps in your campaign.
So, what we're going to be talking about today is, well, very straightforward.
It's a cap.
It's a cap. It's a trapeze. yes. Welcome to the circus. You know what, Brian? This was your idea. Why don't you go ahead and jump off this particular ledge and let people know why we're talking about traps or what it is we're talking about.
Well, in anime...
nope, never mind. Never mind. You have forfeited your talking privileges. So, we're going to be talking a bit about not only what traps are, what they actually do for you in your game, how they can be used effectively, and how they can be made to be interesting, and also some of the common pitfalls of how they are used ineffectively and how sometimes people just look at them as a terrible addition to a game rather than something that makes it more fun.
So, let's start it off with figuring out what particular we're talking about. What counts as a trap?
So, I think, honestly, one of the hallmarks of a trap is usually that it is something either mechanical or arcane, something that physically is triggered by an action or a thing that the player characters do. Because of the fact that inherently a trap is something that was laid by somebody in wait of a certain action or series of actions to be done. Mm. And then that usually means that it's something detrimental is about to happen to the people who then tripped it.
This could be, you know, everything from just a concealed pitfall, a poisoned spring in a lock, to the everyone's favorite arcane glyphs.
Yeah, about, yeah.
Exploding runes. There we go.
Yeah. The glyphs of warding, I believe, is usually the more recent version. Yeah.
Yeah.
So the other thing about this is traps also include things like the more modern versions of them. Claymores, landmines, anti-personnel, anti-vehicle mines, stuff like that.
Barbed wire, barricades, burning tires. I think the easiest way to go about it from this point would be to start talking about what is a trap used for, and then also throw in the types of traps.
Sure, sure.
So, in your guys' campaigns, what most commonly are traps used for? Are they just an inconvenience? Are they specifically to stop people?
Traps are... So, let's make this a little anecdotal.
Sure.
You say, for instance, you are a powerful mage and or priest who has got treasure. You've spent your lifetime accruing this, and you don't really want to give it away.
Right.
So even when you die, you want to make sure it's safe.
Mm-hmm.
And what you do is you find yourself a nice out-of-the-way place, i.e. a dungeon, and you fill it with deterrents and things that will keep, you know, plucky adventurers like you had been in your youth from getting a hold of your fancy stuff. They work as ways of both deterring and destroying those who are not deterred.
Pretty much. So if you're looking for the storyline reason of why a trap would exist, those are excellent ways of going about it. If you're looking for a mechanical reason as to why a trap would exist in a role-playing game of any kind, regardless of setting, regardless of any other reason, a trap or a series of traps is an obstacle the players are they're designed for players to interact with and overcome that doesn't always, but not necessarily, involve combat.
Okay, so they're almost strictly, it seems, a type of land denial.
A lot of the times, yes. There are plenty of different kind of traps that are designed to go down the other directions, to funnel them in a particular direction, to cause them to end up in a particular place at a particular time. But they do miss out on some of the other hallmarks that traps in reality are actually designed to do.
Sure. You want me to go into that or no?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. So, in a real world or realistic sense, a trap is generally designed, be it a mine, a pitfall, a Punji's pit, a foot trap.
Yeah.
Any of these things are designed to do a couple of things. They're designed to deny access, like you're talking about, to deny land usage, so to, you know, block a particular route of travel, or to direct motion, like you're talking about.
Right.
All of them, though, at their core, are also designed to do a couple of things. They're either designed to damage or kill an individual, damage material, so equipment, horses, vehicles, what have you.
Sure.
Or to destroy an object if it falls into the wrong hands.
Right.
So in that capacity, a realistic trap is generally something which is lethal or slightly less than lethal and is designed to cause psychological or physical harm.
Right.
It's designed to slow or stop an opponent until either a force can come in and take care of it, or until somebody can get away.
Right. So some of the things that traps are designed to do in reality don't have a good analog across for most role-playing games, mostly because of the fact that, causing trauma, like mental trauma as well as physical trauma. Mental trauma is very difficult to get across from something that isn't, like, actively taunting a player. If it's something where, oh no, I stepped in a pit trap and I took some damage, it's not traumatizing to a player or a character. I mean, sure, the character might be traumatized, but the player is usually not going to play that up.
Right.
You know, they're not going to have a sudden fear of 10-foot drops just because you've had a couple of them get in their way from point A to point B.
Mm.
But that's also because in Dungeons & Dragons, in most role-playing games, traps are almost the same thing as combat encounters with enemies, and that is because everything in the mechanics of Dungeons & Dragons, or any most role-playing game, is designed as a method of taking resources away from players before they get to a certain point.
Sure, and I mean, that follows on, actually, a little bit into a realistic sense.
Sure.
So,
you were saying, actually destroying resources and destroying equipment.
If I can't get back to use this thing, your treasure, for example, then no one can have it. So I'm going to bring down the walls and prevent access, or I'm going to kill people who are actively there, but I can't do it myself.
Sure.
In your combat encounter sense, the notion of, say, a minefield. Right, a minefield is laid to do a couple of things: deny access or direct motion. It's a combat encounter. It's designed to slow or stop an opponent.
Right.
Right? Or create enough havoc and damage that by the time it gets through to you, it's going to be less of a thing for you to deal with.
Sure, sure.
So your traps kind of act in the same way, I feel, but without the same impact.
Right, and there is a difference between traps that the DM sets versus traps that the players set.
Right.
If only because of the fact that 9 times out of 10, the DM's traps are not designed to instantly kill a player unless the players have some way of circumventing it that makes it so they don't just immediately all die from the same trap.
Sure, sure.
You know, player agency aside, which sometimes will cause them all to die from the same trap.
Player agency is the player's worst enemy.
their own free will is their worst enemy, basically.
You ended Sunday night's session by having your lone mastermind rogue jump into a room full of guards.
Yeah. Sometimes it's the worst possible thing. But the concept of the DM's traps, again, they're actually done encounter-wise the same as monster encounters.
Okay.
They have a challenge level. They have a rating of this is how much experience they should get for circumventing or dealing with this trap.
Right, right.
In the same way that a combat encounter with an enemy of the same challenge rating would deal that with them.
And they scale these with the DCs on how on what skill checks you need to make to defeat this trap, as well as how much damage any failures dole out.
So to follow on with that idea, how often do they flow into combat encounters too?
See, this is where we get into some of the kind of different kinds of traps that exist.
Sure.
Because some of them are purely there for damage. And this is the classic, like, step on a thing and an arrow shoots out of the wall and hits somebody.
Right.
Super classic. That is barely area denial. That is barely funneling someone. That is literally...
It's an inconvenience.
If you step on the thing, you take some damage. It's a Pavlovian response at that point. You know, just don't do that thing. Or bypass it if you can.
Sure.
So that's the most simple type of trap. And that even falls in with things like the classic 10-foot pit. Or the 10-foot pit with spikes in it. Which is just a higher level CR of the same trap.
Mm-hmm.
You know, those are super simple. Just they get in the way of the player and they deal some damage. Done. You then move into other traps which are actively changing the landscape. This is things where you're actively telling the players, do not do these things or your characters will regret it far above and beyond what you normally would. And this is like a minefield. Telling a player, by the way,
yeah,
that if you walk out in that field, your character will explode because it is filled with mines, is going to do one of two things. Either A, it's going to funnel all of them into the area you want them to be in,
mm-hmm.
or they're going to get super brazen, and they're going to be like, sure, I waltz across there, and they're going to rely on their rolls, their luck, their abilities, or whatever, to get them through it.
Sure.
Because a classic way of getting through traps in a lot of Dungeons & Dragons things is, who has the most hit points? Walk through it. Literally trigger the trap and have it hit someone it can't kill. So the idea of area denial only works up to where the other mechanics don't work with it. But the idea of a mechanic where it actually leads into a combat encounter is more of the alarm tripping kind of thing. That's where you get into those traps that are, they themselves aren't damaging, but by not bypassing it or by doing it incorrectly, the players then immediately leap into a situation that they are, like, not going to handle well or that they're in a bad situation where... That killing field aspect.
And it might not be something that's even geared actually to immediately kill them. It could be some situation where it's you step on this trap and now you're going into the boss fight with the slowed condition. Like, you are...
Well, that would be the other real-world aspect we could take into it. Things that aren't necessarily lethal but will slow you down until you enter that kill box you're mentioning.
Yeah.
Or that final boss fight, an alarm, Tanglefoot, a basic kind of wire with, you know, things that go clatter and clank on it to alert somebody of your presence.
Yeah.
Or things that stop you, things that slow you completely, such as ankle trap.
Sure.
Just a couple boards with nails on it that clap over your shin. You can't move until somebody helps you out of it.
Right.
Right. So that then would flow into a combat encounter similar to what you're mentioning, because at that point they know, aha, I have immobilized at least one of them, maybe a couple others, we can go in and maybe finish that guy off.
Yeah, and that's where, when it comes to the actual rules of how Dungeons & Dragons, or most role-playing games, deal with how traps can function, with the addition of magic and other game mechanics that flow into them, you can easily set up traps that do things like, oh, you trip this, now you're slowed for the next combat encounter, or you step in this thing and now you are literally restrained, and then as the moment that happens, a group of enemies might jump out and be like, haha, the big one is now unable to move, and that gives us our advantage, which again, that's where tripping that trap puts the players at a disadvantage in whatever they're going to be doing next.
It flows nicely, because another method of traps or, you know, problems like that in general is harassment and interdiction.
Yeah.
So that flows nicely into the reality you could conceive of while, you know, designing your dungeon or playing your game.
Now, the other side of that, of course, is like I was saying about traps that weren't necessarily designed to kill people outright.
Right.
Because there are quite a lot of traps in real life where They're flat out designed to murder people.
Yeah.
They are there such overwhelming destructive power, you know, in the form of, say, mostly landmines, stuff like that, that sure, they maim a lot of people. Those are the lucky ones. Most people will just die. You know,
most real world designs are designed specifically to cripple an individual, with the notion of bringing in others to help that you can then also eliminate.
Right, and so here's the other thing, though, is in a game where magic exists, if your mm-hmm. campaign world has magic, or if you're in a game system that allows for that sort of thing, bypassing or making the detrimental effects of a trap completely worthless is something that happens quite often. Just as an example, it's like, oh, you're trying to open a chest, and oh no, there's a poison dart in there, and the poison dart sticks you, and now your character's poison.
My character's immune to poison.
Right, or the paladin turn comes over and goes, bing, and now you're fine because you don't have poison anymore.
Sure.
And what that does is, again, in worst case scenario, you completely negate the ability of the trap or what it did to the party. Best case scenario is it takes some resources away that may have been useful to the party as a whole. So that 5 points of healing that the paladin used to cure that poison is 5 points of healing they don't have later on. You know, so the, you know, like a bouncing Betty, exactly, thank you, Hybrid Divide. You know, things that are designed, again, to cripple or maim, where in a D&D game, well, that's going to deal, okay, maybe 2d6 points of piercing damage to everyone within a certain radius. Depending on the level of your party, 2d6 may be nothing.
But if they end up falling down a chute and into a pit where there is a rust monster, suddenly the fighter doesn't have a sword going in through the rest of the bloody encounter.
Yeah, and there are plenty of monsters in the monster manual that are designed, if not just to be used as traps themselves, that work really well alongside traps.
Right.
Because, or they themselves are a trap monster because their physiology, their ability is designed in such a way.
Are we going to talk about
Gelatinous Cube?
Your favorite? Your very favorite? Mimics!
Oh, yeah, mimics, man. Mimics are a great example of a trap creature. I was actually going to go on the idea of a roper, or the...
Oh, ropers are another great one.
Yeah. Which are...
Shambling mounds.
Mm-hmm. Things that blend into their surroundings that utilize their stealth nature of whatever they are to lure in prey that they then attack.
Sure.
So the creature is the trap at that point, rather than having to have any sort of mechanical or arcane trap there. So the one thing I know I wanted to get into, though, when it came into traps in your game, was a couple things that I've seen happen in a lot of role-playing games that I've run and that I've been in. And this is where you get into a little bit of the fatigue of traps. So I will go out on a limb and say that a lot of games generally include at least one character that has the ability to disarm a trap.
Okay? Most campaigns, yes.
Right. So,
it's called party balance. We did a show about it once.
Right. So the concept of, you know, you have your adventuring party, you're going to make your way down into this crypt and all that. Well, what do you do? Do you send the fighter first and let them soak up damage, or do you send the rogue literally inching their way across the floor, checking for traps every foot that they move, and actively searching for these things? And then the moment they find them, they roll to disarm. And if they succeed, they succeed. If they don't, then they deal with it and you move on. It's not interesting if you have a whole dungeon or a series of traps that basically boil down to one person at your table rolling disarm over and over and over again. And there's no reason why a DM would ever be like, well, you can't disarm this one. It's like, well, you just disarmed the three other ones. What makes this one special that you can't just roll a disable device on? You have to have
MacGuffin's
a good reason
behind it.
Sure, why not? But, you know, eventually you're basically just saying your class ability doesn't function on this.
Yeah.
Which, unless you come up with a good storyline reason, is super crap.
It's sort of bunk. It's being like, hey, you know that thing that you're specialized in? Well, I'm taking it away because I can't figure out a way to write around it.
Yeah. We talked a bit about this in the show about the giving the players a chance to shine, making everyone feel like they have a moment to do something cool.
Yeah.
And when we had our meeting afterwards for the GM workshop here locally, which, by the way, is third Thursdays of every month down at Ashley's Pub in Bremerton, Washington. If you make it down there, it's great.
Show up. The pints are good.
Yeah. But we had a discussion, and I came up to a point, and this is something I'd like to bring up now because it's very relevant, is that when you're designing encounters, whether they be traps, whether they be combat encounters, whether they be anything you're doing, everything should be looked at like doors and keys.
Yeah.
And traps especially, whether they be literal doors and keys or whether they be figurative, the idea is when you come up to a trap is a classic example of a door with usually one key. Two if you're feeling brash. The brash key is send the fighter in and soak up the damage and disarm the trap by literally activating it. The normal key is to send the rogue in to disarm it. But if you, in your dungeon, have seven different doors that require the same key, no one else gets to have fun with that. No one else gets to be the key. No one else gets to have that moment where they are helping you, the party, move through an issue or an encounter. You know, you might throw in some combat encounters where now you're melee people and some spellcasting gets thrown around. But the concept of those doors need to have different keys, and you need to basically force the players into a position where they are relying on each other to make things happen. So if you are going to have a door that requires someone to disable device, there's no reason why you can't throw like another skill check on top of that that needs to be done simultaneously.
Say it's a magic trap, and while the rogue doesn't really have much in the way of magic, you certainly have a wizard there. They can make an arcana check while the rogue is in the middle of his disabled device check. So suddenly they're working together to dismantle something that could theoretically be a lot more damning to their party.
Yeah, or for example, what happens if the lock that needs to be opened or the trap, like the access panel for the trap that needs to be undone, is underneath or behind a very heavy rock that needs to be lifted out of place while the trap is being disarmed. Which means not only do you have your heavy bruiser character lifting this massive rock and having to hold it still and either rolling endurance or strength checks while the rogue is attempting to disarm it, you now add a level where not only another skill check is being introduced so other players get involved, yeah, but now there's that level of difficulty where if this person fails a check, the person who would normally be out of danger is suddenly in danger.
I like that. Multi-part systems. It works well.
Yeah. So the concept of doors and keys is something that I recommend people think about in their methods of dungeon or encounter creation. Hmm. And traps are just another way of putting a door in their place. We actually, funny enough, when we were down talking, we brought up several traps. For example, what is a good trap from movies that everyone would basically know, and I threw out there and said, hey, what about the penitent man shall pass? Okay?
Sure.
This is a trap. It is obviously a dungeon trap, okay? Mm-hmm. This is a very normal and everyday dungeon trap. Spinning blades come out of wall by stepping on pressure plate. Neat. What is the key? How do you get through this? Okay, right off the bat, we're looking at the concept of you can be dexterous to get through it. Okay, you just make a bunch of reflex checks and you're through it, or dex checks, or whatever the analog is.
But what if I wanted to solve it with bardic lore?
Boom! The DM has now introduced a way of solving the puzzle using a knowledge skill. Because one of the players is like, oh, the penitent man shall pass. Yes, kneel. That makes sense. And you either giving them a massive bonus on their reflex, or they're allowed to bypass the trap by basically learning and using that other skill.
Hmm.
You know, which then can let the rest of the party through. Because once a key has been discovered, let it work. You know, don't just arbitrarily throw that key out and say, haha, this one is only a one use.
Let there be like a lever at the end of the hallway. Something that makes it so by actually conquering the check, you negate the trap.
Mm-hmm. Or alternatively, a strength check for grabbing rubble from nearby and throwing it into the hallway, which now blocks all the spinning blades from even getting out of their areas. Because chances are the spinning blades aren't going to be able to move, you know, a ton of rocks that you literally just strewn around the hallway. So that is a way of getting around it and working through that trap. And the point I'm trying to get here, as I'm roundabout getting there, is don't always just have one way of solving it. You know, your pile of mines, right? Your landmines that you have strewn around between your, you know, setting up that kill zone.
Yeah.
What if they can fly? What if they come up with a really cool way of doing it? What if they summon a bunch of monsters and let them loose in the field to blow up a bunch of the mines before they get through there?
NATO came up with a solution to that. It's a helicopter mine.
So there you go.
It's a magnetic mine you put in a treetop.
Nice. And see, that's a great way of basically screwing over people once they have utilized that same tactic too many times.
Yeah.
The enemy, if they're still alive, will learn that tactic and come up with with something to counter it. But the concept of like, okay, now someone's going to throw a bunch of giant ball bearings out in that field and detonate a bunch of mines to make it safe for them to go through, which can work in a pinch. But it might make it less dangerous, but and as brought up in the chat, yes, a trap is disarmed if it is broken. Breaking traps is a great way of getting around them if the DM will allow it to happen. But again, if you always allow that key to open that door, then your rogue, who's designed to disable traps, no longer gets to have fun.
I think from my point of view, I would still caution GMs to consider how real-world traps and mines are used.
Sure.
Definitely keep it in mind in any encounter you're planning, any dungeon you're planning. You know, what are you attempting to do with these traps? Is it simply to stop or hinder? Or, mm-hmm. you know, can you use these in a creative way? Even with your multi-key system, even with, you know, the things we brought up earlier in the show, can you use these to further your combat encounters or the narrative itself and apply narrative to the traps themselves?
Mm-hmm. And that's actually something that's very important, is whereas the players themselves or the characters involved are not going to be the ones that are going to be really traumatized by your traps.
Mm.
There's something to be said that when the players act, something happens to someone who isn't them.
You know, let's say using your narrative or your parable or whatever.
Brian's parable.
Anecdote.
Brian's
anecdote.
That's my toast word.
Okay.
Anywho, using that, let's say it's a more modern day setting as I tend to default to. You're in a kind of bombed out building. You've got to go through to find your bit, your MacGuffin at the end of a series of hallways. Living traps.
Oh yeah.
You talked about creatures. Let's instead add some of the horror aspect and say that it's a wounded individual on the floor.
Right.
If you move them, if you attempt to help them, they will blow up in your face.
Yeah.
You know, that's psychological in nature. You know, area denial, you can do pitfalls, you can do any number of things, but think about how best to implement those things to affect the party and the story.
Yeah, absolutely. You should never just throw a bunch of traps at the party and be like, haha, this will be fun, because 9 times out of 10 it will either devolve into the one person disarming all of them, or you will murder your party halfway through a hallway because you decided to throw a flaming burst trap along with a pit trap, along with two oozes that drop from the ceiling, along with...
Don't get too effective with your traps.
Right, and that actually is a great way to move on, because of the fact that it is so easy to have sometimes a trap that seemed, I don't know, really simplistic or really something you thought your party would just bypass, suddenly becomes the bane of their existence. As an example, a 20-foot drop with a ladder murdered half our Dark Heresy group.
Nice.
Your Dark Heresy group was not terribly...
No, our Dark Heresy group were stupid, and we made bad decisions, and when someone decided they were going to jump down a, what was it, you know, basically a 7-meter fall, you know?
A 7-meter? Yeah, that's going to
hurt. 21
feet,
right?
That's going to hurt.
So 7 meters does a lot of damage in Dark Heresy, and when several people tried to jump down because there were bad guys down at the bottom of this ladder, because no one wanted to be caught moving on the ladder,
right?
They jumped down, and half of them died.
Nice.
Because, you know, Dark Heresy doesn't have things like cover fire or anything like that, which it totally does, and your characters were all terrible.
Yes. But the point was, is that even innocuous things like some enemies at the bottom of a ladder can murder your players when it's handled in a certain way. So the concept of having traps that are utilized in a good way, in a way of making your party feel like they are the ones that it was designed for.
Right.
Or at least giving them a special way of getting through it can be really good. But sometimes that hole in the wall is going to be so interesting that every single party member is going to stick their hand in it, and they're going to come away with stumps.
What are you doing in here, little girl? Why do you have that teddy bear?
Sure, right.
Oh, God, your head is split open, and it's actually a saw.
Yeah. So the problems like that can occur.
What, you never saw Screamers?
No.
Their face extended, and it was like a cannon or something. I forget.
So, right. But the concept of when you're designing your traps, when you're designing your particular encounters that you're going to be dealing with them, remember, these aren't just a one-sided thing. You wouldn't create a combat encounter that relies on a single party member to get through it. So why design your traps that way? You know, if a trap is supposed to stop like a lone rogue or a thieves guild or something like that from getting in, maybe have those traps be something that the entire party has to put their effort towards doing, you know, or even having several things that require people to do things simultaneously, like I mentioned before.
Skill challenges!
Yeah, I actually put this to very good use a little while back where I was running Starfinder. And in our Starfinder game, I had a series of trap rooms that required the entire party to be doing a lot of things. The first thing was, you know, there was a single computer panel on the outside door.
Yeah.
When they used that to open the door, it actually let them into the first room. The first room had another computer panel and a locked door. When you started activating that computer panel, it shut the first door and opened a side panel that had another keypad to open the door in the room. But that one, when you failed a check, a blade would come swinging down.
Nice.
So someone had to be actively hacking one panel, and if they failed, the blade would hack down on the person trying to open the next door in.
Shifted consequences.
Right.
Yeah.
So it wasn't even a direct thing. So the person who was making the check wasn't even like, oh, I'm going to get hurt by doing this. It's my friend is going to lose a finger. You know, which it happened. One of our characters lost a finger in that encounter.
Yeah.
Did it grow back?
Yeah, the next one was a combat encounter where the actual room itself sectioned off with force fields every round.
Resident Evil style.
Yeah, so that... actually, it was more like the Darth Maul fight in Episode 1, where they kept getting separated by force fields, and certain people were now in the area to fight, and then other people weren't. And then the enemies who knew what was going to happen were able to maximize their effect and go after the weaker people because they knew how the cycle was going to go.
I want to point out that Hybrid totally called this.
He did.
Right in the beginning of the
episode. And I was going to get to it, you know. So thank you, Hybrid Divide. I'm glad you were in that encounter. It was very fun. And then later on, there was the Resident Evil one, which was the lasers coming down the hallway. But I added tiny flying drones that would automatically get zip through the spaces between the lasers so they weren't affected. So it was a running fight from one end of the hallway to the other while they were trying to fight off floating drones and dodge through lasers. The lasers weren't super damaging. They actually were really low damage.
We ended up all just going, running through it, ow, it hurts!
And by the time they got to the end, the boss fight, they had used about 3/4 of their abilities just getting to that point.
So but you
we
mixed,
still had a bag of grenades.
You mixed Resident Evil with Phantasm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, so, you know, coming up with the way that I made it so that every player felt that they were useful in that encounter, because the people who were doing hacking were able to hack, the people who were good at combat were able to do combat, the people who were tactically minded were able to decide where they were going to be and what they were doing, and then at the end I had a combat encounter that was just, that involved everybody and their fighting ability. So it used a little bit of everything, but it made it so that at no point was I just letting one person, because I know with our players especially that there would have been one person who has all of the skills necessary to just, oh, I hack through this door. Oh, I hack through this door. Oh, I hack through this door. And literally it's just follow behind the computer guy until we're at the boss.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. It's a good use.
So I would recommend that any DM out there do roughly the same thing, coming up with the concept of utilizing every player's skills to get through your traps. So if you are going to use things like minefields, if you are going to use things like a trap that leads into an encounter, let the players come up with interesting ways of getting around them instead of relying on a single person.
Yeah, absolutely.
But do use those fun, normal ones. I mean, a 10-foot pit is a great trap to use from time to time.
And it's awful when PCs get their hands on the ability to create 10-foot pits.
Yeah. And then, you know, the only way you have to make them more difficult is add spikes for that first level of difficulty. Add acid for that second level of difficulty. Add spikes and acid for that third level of difficulty. You know, and a glyph of warding at the bottom. So it's literally just a giant pit of fuck you to your players. Because you fall down, you get impaled on spikes, acid drips down on you, and then you explode.
What is this, the background from Mortal Kombat 2?
Right? See, that's the thing, is you can do that to a higher level party because they have the hit points to spare. Because a single, like, a single d6 of damage to a 19th level player isn't going to matter. But, you know, 15 d6 for that level, for someone falling in and having all this bad stuff happen to them, that's a bit more of a drain on resources.
Absolutely.
So gain that drain on... Or gauge that drain on the party themselves. Gauge the drain on your party.
Of pain.
Don't have a single encounter take away everything. Don't have a single encounter matter nothing.
Turn your party into a stain.
Right?
No. Sorry.
Gain that pain.
In Spain.
So, overall, I think that is a pretty good primer on how I would discuss traps. And when it comes to the real-world use of them and how that they are effective, you know, Justin...
Land denial.
Yep.
Harassment. Directed motion. Denying access.
Mm-hmm.
Psychological, physical damage, and the destruction of materia.
Right.
And remember, let everyone take a crack at it. Make it something that is more than one person challenges.
Mm-hmm. And don't give them a master key. Whatever you do, never apply, unless it is something very important.
It only works from like 2 feet from the doorknob anyway. You really don't want one.
Well, in one case, the master key in one of my campaigns was an adamantine hand axe. It was the, I can cut open any door. Yeah, because you're referring to the master key, which is a shotgun specifically designed to open doors.
About yay big.
Yeah. You know, but in my game, it was an adamantine hand axe because it ignored hardness and people were like, oh, we can't open this door. I cut open the lock. Because I ignore hardness and I can just chop at it until it's gone. Oh, I cut the hinges off of the door. Whatever they wanted, they literally would just cut their way through because the game system gave them a master key.
Yeah.
Sounds like what you needed is a complicated, thick stone wall that slides away. And if they break the lock, well, they're going to just have to spend the next couple hours with possible enemies coming in from behind them.
Complex target.
And that's the other thing, is showing them that their master key is going to just be more problematic, because as with balancing any sort of competitive game, the moment that there is a single method of doing the thing better, everyone will do it that way.
Absolutely.
You know, when assault rifles got more powerful than anything else, everyone uses assault rifles. When hand cannons got more powerful than anything else, everyone used hand cannons. It's, you know, that was a balance issue in Destiny, but it's the same thing. There was an optimal route. So... Wrong
this
kind
is
of cannon.
Why I was very bad at Destiny.
It's
like
just
because
a tiny
I was like,
cannon.
I never want to do optimal round.
But it's the same thing of any sort of like competitive FPS. The moment that there is an optimal solution, everyone will use it because that is the best way to do it. And if your D&D game has something that will work every time, you know. I'm saying this isn't me. This is competitive
level. We're exceptions
level.
To the rule.
I absolutely believe you and accept this. I just find myself to be the unfortunate exception because I like to make every FPS into a melee game.
Right.
And I break convention.
Right. But when we're talking the highest echelons of play, where all
that's
of those specifics
us.
Matter.
Yeah,
that's
not
right.
us.
But
no.
that's something that takes into play. And when you're playing a D&D game, when you tell your players, oh, by the way, you can just do this to succeed, they will just do this to succeed. So that's the problem. Don't give them a master key unless you're prepared to have them use it on everything. You know, so I guess the issue is when you're running a Star Wars game, how often does the Jedi use his lightsaber for everything? Oh, can't open the door? Lightsaber.
You know, if you drop that, it's just going straight through the planet.
Cut open a hole in a bulkhead.
It's just never going to stop.
You know, whatever.
But then you get catharsis.
Right. But again, then all you're doing is applying a Band-Aid and saying, oh, you know that master key you've been relying on this entire campaign? It doesn't work in this situation.
You know that chainsword you've been using that's nuclear powered? Oh, you dropped it and it's on. Yeah. It, off on a journey.
Right. How often does the, do at that point, how many of your enemies are all going to have Cortosis Weave? Does every enemy at that point now have it because you can't deal with the character who used that lightsaber?
Well, it depends on how big a problem are Jedis in your particular game world.
Also true.
Because that necessitates a completely different thing. If there are Jedis everywhere throwing around lightsabers like they're candy, Cortosis Weave alloys are probably one of the most highly sought-after materials.
Sure. But the idea is that if every single enemy at that point now is immune to your trick, that makes the player who built their entire character around doing that thing feel worthless. And that's you've done it wrong.
That player has also done it wrong because you shouldn't ever build your entire character around a piece of equipment.
It's not your job, though. You as a DM are designed to work with the characters and their decisions, not limit them because you don't like what they did.
You've given them so many minds to tackle. It was just that one moment when it was command detonated that it became a problem.
Right, and every so often that's great, but if every single mine after that point becomes command detonated, then
no,
it's,
you gotta
vary it. Then you're a bad DM.
Throw it up.
Right.
Throw it up. Just physically just vomit these things out.
Yeah, just everywhere.
Yeah, also, yes, Jedi is a plural. Not Jedis.
Jedis.
But the thing is, and this actually goes, before moving on, a lot of adventure games, a lot of like action adventure games have this problem. How many times do they give you this really cool, awesome ability, and then the next monster you fight is immune to that ability? You know, oh, I can't use my heavy attack on these because they have a turtle shell. I can't fight those guys with this. And you have to find that one specific weapon to fight them with. And it feels cheap because later in the game, it becomes, I guess I just have to wail on everything because everything is immune to all the cool shit they gave me up to this point.
Well, sure, it feels cheap, and you're right, it is poor role-playing. But, I mean, if you do your reading, do your research, and do some thinking about it, use a spread of traps just like you would in the real world.
Yeah.
In a real situation, you would not rely on one thing. It would not be the same gimmick over and over again. You'd be varying it up. You'd be making it different a little bit every time.
Yeah, give the players a reason to be on their toes. Give them something that they have to deal with. But again, don't let them use their master key on everything.
Exactly.
So, I think that's about as much as...
we're going to talk about this on this particular...
I will probably be having some sort of discussion at one point specifically about the concept of doors and keys in your design philosophy.
Will you?
Yeah, but I'll be bringing it up more often in different episodes.
Okay.
Just because it fits for so many things. But in this case, I think we are going to move on to the Twitface Mail
Tumble. Don't do it.
I shouldn't say
God damn
Sith.
It.
Sorry, I'm being
You have already ruined the chat.
If you're going to respond to the chat, make sure you're keeping it in context for those people who are listening at home who don't know the chat.
Sorry.
It has become Star Wars. It's all Star Wars.
They're all talking about Sith and Jedi now, yeah. Which is fine. I'm totally okay with that.
Hey, you know what? We've got answers to episode 154's question, which went a little something like this.
When were you the center of attention?
Draconic! Being the GM means I'm often the center of attention unless the players choose to interact with one another.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Don't you hate it when they do?
And if you, as
I'm
the
trying
GM...
trying to tell a story!
I was going to say, if the GM is the center of attention, then they need to shift that over to one of the player characters for them to be the focus of what the players are interested in.
Jay... When was I not the center of attention? Seriously, though, I have to deal a lot with presenting to studios and schools and stuff.
Indeed. I believe Jasmine from Fanfic Radio is works for game developers and such. So I can see how that would make you the center of attention, having to go and make those presentations. So more power to you.
Yes.
Savvy responds with, I actively avoid being the center of attention when possible. I think most recent was in Oregon at Powell's when Justin and I got engaged.
I did that.
Yes, you did. That was both wonderful and overwhelming.
And nearly ruined because everyone was standing at the elevator door when it opened.
Yeah, we're fine. Everything was good. It went really
quick
well.
Quick thinking.
Yeah.
Sir Jeff Jeffers. Kid lost it. Wait. Nope.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes. Kid lost his Yu-Gi-Oh! Deck during invitationals to the regionals. I happened to find it lying around 10 minutes or so before it was reported lost, and luckily found the kid and his dad upset and leaving. asked if they were okay, mentioned they lost the deck, and I told them I turned one in moments ago. Whee! The officials made it known over the speaker system and pointed me out. Had 300-ish people clapping and cheering for me. It felt so weird.
That is pretty cool.
That's pretty rad, though.
It's going to be weirder still when you start realizing that everywhere you go, people will randomly just stare at you with a blank look on their face and clap unexpectedly for minutes on end.
Like you do.
Stopping as you get about a block away.
No, I don't like this. Moral truth. Moral, I need healing.
Nice. Being a healer means you are always going to be the center of attention, whether you like it or not.
Except, you know, I would have healed you guys if you hadn't let me die.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Bodigo, I was center of attention last week when I had you guys order and eat pizza midstream. This is true, and it's true. Do indeed appreciate it, although I'm not sure the people listening to the recorded podcast release understood.
They mentioned it, but then they got to listen to us eat.
Those wonderful ASMR sounds that we're going to start releasing.
Saying that for like at least a year and a half.
The
now.
Chips video is one of our most popular.
It really is not. Anyway, thank you, Digidicers, for responding to last episode's question. But once again, we ask yet another question because we are insatiable and we require that interaction to function.
Yes, indeed. And this week we have a question, and it goes a little something like this.
When should you have set out traps, real or game-related?
Yeah, we would like to know, dear Digidicers, whether it be a role-playing game or just a situation in your life, when would it have been beneficial to you to have set out traps?
You know, I didn't realize at the time, but living in Seattle with two people we both know, I didn't realize I might have to booby-trap the cupboard in which my peanut butter lived.
I heard about that. I heard that your peanut butter in the apartment got violated.
It did, in just that's the most obscene and odd way. And, you know, it should have been protected, and I failed it.
Yours is that you should have booby-trapped your GIF?
Yes.
Okay. In which case, there would have been grievous bodily harm to the next person to stick an appendage in there.
That sounds...
Except for, you know, anyone who is going to use it in the correct manner who would know that those traps existed.
That's fair. That's fair.
Which would have been anyone else in that place.
Don't fuck your peanut butter, kids.
Yeah, don't do it. Oh my God. Don't do it.
Brian, what about you?
Well, threw that one out there. I actually did set up a mild booby trap.
In the chat that someone said a thing that the people at home aren't going
to
know?
Oh, yes, hybrid. Well, I'm about to relate the anecdote
there.
Don't
interrupt
buddy.
Him. It takes anecdote forever to get back to it.
Don't that anek.
So...
I'm listening.
When I was living with my family, my stepfather and little brother had a habit of eating all my jelly beans that I had. And so one day I bought several boxes of every flavored jelly bean, the Harry Potter stuff.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Belly jeans.
And then me and Hybrid Divide went through that entire case of these jelly beans and picked out all the ones that are even vaguely palatable. And then I left a nice little tray of jelly beans next to the computer, right where they've been stealing them. And everyone was very upset. They're like, "What? What is this? What are you eating?" I ate all the good ones.
What is it?
Yes.
Nice.
So
nice.
That was
the Bernie Bots. Yes.
A delightfully harm-free.
Nice. I mean, I've done something similar to that, but that's the kind of thing where, like, you're just a monster for mixing in Reese's Pieces and Skittles in the same bowl, you know?
Why would you do that?
Because sometimes you just want to watch the world burn.
Those are both beautiful things, but if you combine them, it's awful.
Hand me something else that's not going to hurt it while I throw it at him. That is horrible.
Because you can mix M&M's and Reese's Pieces all day long, and it's not a problem. But the moment it's Skittles and Reese's...
You're awful! You're the devil! This person is terrible!
So again, that question was, when should you have set out traps, real or game-related? And now we're going to move on to shout-outs.
Yes, indeed.
We have some wonderful people we'd like to thank from our Patreon.
Yes, our Patreon supporters, we would like to thank Astonishing Legends, Golden Bolt, Desmond.
Hi, Desmond.
Hi, Desmond. Hi, Desmond. Patrick M., McMindflare, Botigo, SquareBear23, Chubby Wildcat, and Odd Shape Channel.
Woo!
Thank you very, very much.
Thank you so much for being our patrons.
Also, because I'm just going to jump in with it, we use Pippa.io for our podcast hosting service, and we do indeed recommend it for anyone who's about to launch or has a project already out there.
Yeah, we absolutely recommend it. They are really great.
Switching over was a really, really easy thing to do.
Their analytics are really super easy to use as well, so I highly recommend it. But I did want to also throw out there that we are going to be moving forward with a slight difference in our release schedule. For those of you who are interested in our myriad shows, i.e. Creature Pasta, SGO Files, and Hazardous Endeavors, there is going to be a little bit of a change in release for a couple of them. First off, Creature Pasta is going to continue on its every other week release schedule.
Yes.
But we are going to be moving SGO Files as well to an every other week release schedule for several reasons.
The first being that we love it and all of you and would like it to be as great for all of you as possible.
Absolutely. We want to include a little bit more shine and polish on it. We want to maybe get a little bit more time to reach out to the authors. Absolutely guarantee that we have all of the permissions required from them to make the episodes that you guys want to hear. So, you know, we without doing it last minute, without having to remove anything that may not have necessarily given us permission on time, we want to make sure that they are, you know, given the time needed.
And we also want to make sure that they're polished and developed a little more than they have been so far.
Yeah.
Also, Mark puts a lot of work on that, and we don't want to quite necessarily burden him completely out. Only mostly.
Nice. Right. Because he does only have the one job.
Right. Speaking
of
which,
job that Mark has.
Speaking of which, when it comes to Hazardous Endeavors, we are maintaining our weekly release schedule for now. There is some talk that possibly later on towards season two, we might move into a 2-week schedule, but we are still deciding on that. If we are adding some stuff like maybe increasing the amount of sound effects that we have in there, making the animation a little bit better, some other work that I want to put in there that requires a bit more work, because unless our Patreon suddenly explodes into the mainstream and we are able to work on this full time, we all three still have 40-hour-a-week jobs, and editing 4 shows is a bit difficult. So, you know, we appreciate all the support we are getting from all of you, and hopefully you will you'll be nice and patient with us as we move forward.
Indeed, and thank you for joining us this week. Keep in touch with us at our website and various social networking sites.
You can reach us on Facebook at facebook.com/digitalanddice.
You can reach us on Tumblr at digitalanddice.tumblr.com.
For email and Google Plus, you can find us at digitalanddice@gmail.com.
Follow at digitalanddice on Twitter. Tweet, tweet.
You can donate to your favorite podcast on the internet or us by visiting patreon.com/digitalanddice.
That's patreon.com/digitalanddice.
And don't forget, everyone, you can check us out at our website, www.digitalanddice.com, which goes the same, and you can find all of our shows there on the website and links to everywhere else, like our Twitch and our YouTube and our Discord and all that.
And as we say at the end of every show, please take a moment to leave us a review on iTunes especially, but wherever you have found us. Those analytics used specifically on iTunes do indeed make it so that more people see us.
Mm-hmm.
And the more stars and ratings you're willing to give, not only to us, but any show you listen to, are greatly appreciated.
Yeah, almost everywhere that allows for ratings and reviews are more likely to show those and to put them up on the front page if they have more interaction, more comments, more reviews, more positive things. The more people talk about a thing, the more they will promote it. Mm-hmm. So that really can help us a lot, and that goes for any one of our shows that you enjoy or any other show out there that you're a fan of.
Well, we leave you now with Final Fantasy VII Cosmo by MK Vaff to keep you entertained until next week when we return with more news rants and opinions on general internet loot.
But never fear, we shall return.
And until then,
Game on Internets!
Make us the music.
Cut off the microphones.
Do the thing.